Thank you, and I'm so glad you chose a great song, because that's actually naturally what's in the environment, right? And exactly how the talk title came up, in a way, was, you know, the message, you know, it doesn't really matter. I've got a couple of my congregants from Unity of New Braunfels visiting with you today. I don't know how often they are always here, but they know that my recurring message is always going to circle back to oneness and love. I mean, honestly, we can talk about that 52 weeks a year, 365, and we still haven't heard all the miracles that come when we have an awareness of our oneness and our love. So that, well, if you'll just forgive me, that's probably where I'm gonna end up. I don't know for sure, but that's probably it. But I will bring to your focus something you probably already are very conscious of, and that is that we have so many events in our world, and recent times in particular, nationally, internationally, worldwide, there's such great fear just seems to be prevalent. It always has been, naturally, but doesn't it feel like it's at a fever pitch? And the deal is, I think we're so much better connected technologically. We're so aware by this neural network we call the internet that really connects us from all over the world, that things just get rattled, and this greater fear and sense of need for greater measures for security and for autonomy and separateness in some ways has really isolated us in ways. We live in a climate of fear and uncertainty so often. As we mature spiritually, however, the calling becomes greater for us, more intense. As we spiritually mature and heal ourselves, it isn't just for living a better life, you know? Unity's really great at connecting us with living better. And absolutely, that's our heritage. Absolutely, that is a worthy enterprise, a worthy direction and goal. It is for that, because we are beloved by infinite love, and we are lifted up, and every opportunity and goodness is already pressing in upon us to the level that we allow it into our lives, that we create space for it, that we accept that we deserve that. And as we mature in that, and as we heal, the call to be able to be in service to the world becomes greater and more intensive, I believe. And this is the call, I think, that we are experiencing. Because as we become more balanced and peaceful, we actually have something to offer to the world we may not have been able to before. As we're able to share ourselves authentically, service becomes a pleasure and possibly even a passion for us. It becomes a stronger drive than ever before, and it becomes a matter of personal integrity. Now, if you're sitting there thinking, well, I've got plenty of things on my plate, and I have so many things I do, and I'm being pulled in so many directions that finding peacefulness and time for myself is a challenge, I'm with you. I mean, totally get that. But what I'll also ask you is to take a look at your life in the sense of priorities and ask yourself, are you targeting and on purpose for something that just lives and breathes through you, that just brings you alive? Something, even if it's not full time, you know, we get that confused with, I got to be able to make a living at it or something. You know, ministers are blessed, most of us. I can't speak for all ministers, but I will say for me personally, I am blessed to be able to do the thing I love and get paid for it, sort of. But, you know, I do get paid for it. And that is a huge privilege, and I never lose sight of the privilege that is. And I will also say that you wouldn't have to pay me if you would let me get up and do this. I'm sorry. I'm sure Leah's going, really? We could have had it for nothing? My husband would probably have to call you. I mean, that would be the only thing. But I would say that this is really the deal, isn't it? That you know that what it is that you want to do, It doesn't matter how much of your time and energy you have. It's like it is such a pleasure to be able to touch and to reach and to speak from your heart and to do the thing, whatever it is, whatever you do with your hands or with your words or with your intellect or with technology or wherever your gifts are, with woodworking or with creativity or these beautiful, you know, these beautiful wall hangings of the 12 powers that have always been an identifying icon for this ministry since they've been hung. It is really a powerful reinforcement of where love and all of its ways are necessary and important in our lives and continue to bless when we instill them with the love that we are. Our world needs spiritually based people turned on to serve. That's the answer to that question. We need spiritually based people turned on to serve. Our world needs the true strength and courage of love, understanding, and compassion, not the brute strength that fear invokes. Please hear that to be loving, to be compassionate, to be understanding is not to be a doormat, not to let anything goes, everything's okay, anybody can do whatever they want. That is a toxic version, extreme version of love, and it is not true love. Love, authentically, clearly placed, secure, and coming from that place of love has boundaries. Not that love itself doesn't transcend boundaries. In fact, it does. But in our negotiations and our relationships, boundaries are healthy, important, and necessary. And consequences to actions are important. And that is what a spiritually evolved person has learned, where they end and others begin, and how it is to have healthy relationships that are honoring and respectful. And that includes not just as individuals, but as societies and as the world. It translates in different ways as we go up that scale. But it is the same love energy that has the same understanding that both can prosper if both don't necessarily live in each other's environment. Make sense? So I want to remind you that not to shirk away from love when things really get tough and that we've got to get harder about things. Love belongs there too. How we set those boundaries and how we set those requirements and those necessary rules is important to recognize that there is a place for love, understanding, and compassion in that experience. We cannot afford to live in compartmentalized spirituality any longer, reserving the display of our beliefs for certain areas of our life. Sunday morning here, it's easy to be in like-minded, you know, bliss with one another. It's blissful here, right, all the time, right? And there's no personality conflicts, nothing like that, right? Well, that's good, because that's how it is at Unity of New Braunfels, right? Yeah, no, none of that. So the deal is that it's easy to be who we are here. It's easy to speak from that place. Ask yourself what other times of the week, what other relationships in your life, what other places do you go that you shirk back, and you may not necessarily say the same things to people in the same way that you speak to your friends here. Perhaps it's time to reevaluate how much of you is shining out in the world and how much of it could be shining more. The world needs it. We cannot allow spectator spirituality to sit by the wayside, sit on the sidelines, and say, when they figure it all out, when they finally get the truth or figure out what the truth is, then they'll come around, then they'll see it my way. In the meantime, I'm over here doing my thing. The reason they don't have it is because you're not out there. They haven't heard it from you. And I don't mean the whole world is waiting for you. I just mean the world in which you are navigating in, the world close at hand, at your elbow. The next encounter that you have is for you, and it's an opportunity Spirit allows every moment for you to see what advantage could you bring, what clarity, what light, what compassion, what understanding. And I don't mean tell them how that many ways they're wrong. I mean, listen deeply to what they fear. and absorb that fear, recognize you have it in you too in some other way, and to bless it with love and reassurance about another way to see things. When I'm in fear, I often say this. And that's a way to feel connected and not make anybody right and nobody wrong. The world needs to see our beliefs displayed in our actions, in our words, and most of all, from our hearts. Beliefs like there's only one power for good and that evil has no power. That is an important remembrance in this time of polarization and vilification. All of the things that are coming out of people's mouths are, you know, not only rhetoric, but extreme rhetoric. And not only disrespectful, but malicious in so many ways. In our public discourse, it's been a long time since we've had any of this so prevalent in our lives. We've taken it for granted. It's probably an effect of our social media, where we all have liberty to publish every wild thought and every passing notion that we have in vivid form, or pass on somebody else's vivid form, and all of that, that it just becomes part of the climate in which we live. How can my thoughts, words, actions align with the power of love? How can I be a voice for love in this? The Talmud, which is a collection of Jewish wisdom, says, "Do not be daunted by the enormity of the world's grief. Do justly now. Love mercy now. Walk humbly now. You are not obligated to complete the work, but neither are you free to abandon it." It's our responsibility, each of us. How are we carrying it? What more might we do? Clarissa Pinkola Estes said, "Ours is not the task of fixing the entire world at once, but of stretching out to mend the part of the world that is within our reach." That's the call. So who or what is in your area of influence? What could you say or do differently than maybe you have before, or maybe ever? Who can you listen to with more love? Because I'll tell you what, does the world need more words? Maybe not. Does it need more listening? And undoubtedly, people are not feeling heard, that's why they're yelling. Robert Goss, in Chicken Soup for the Soul, many years ago, published this story. Please bear with me, I'm reading it to you. I love to read stories, and this one is it. So settle back. It was a family adventure trip. My wife Judith, our two-year-old daughter Layla, and I had rented a small camper and were traveling through Baja California. The day before our return to San Diego, we parked the camper near a beach for one last night in nature. In the middle of the night, I was awakened by Judith poking me with her elbow and yelling at me to get up. My first impressions were of noise and banging, and so fairly disoriented, I jumped down out of our little loft bed and standing stark naked facing the windshield. What I saw woke me quickly out of my half-dazed state. I saw the van was surrounded by masked men banging on the windows. Having watched a lot of adventure movies, I always wondered what I would feel and do when confronted with danger. Well, I leapt right into the hero's role, of course, I felt no fear in the moment. It was time to save the family. So I dove for the driver's seat and turned the ignition. Now, the camper had started perfectly at least 50 times that trip. Now, it tried to turn over, it sputtered a few times and died. There was the sound of breaking glass, and a hand reached in through the driver's side window. I smashed the hand. My hand was bleeding from the broken glass. I figured I had one more chance to start the car. Having played hero successfully 1,000 times in fantasy, I never doubted I would do it. I turned the key, the engine sputtered to life, and then died. And then someone jammed a rifle into my throat. I remember this thought. You mean I don't save the family? I was really quite surprised. One of the bandits, who spoke a little English, was yelling, "Money, money!" The rifle still at my throat, I reached under the driver's seat and handed one of them my wallet through the broken window. I was hoping that would be the end of it. It wasn't. Releasing the latch through the broken window, they opened the door. The man with the rifle pushed me hard and sent me sprawling onto the floor. They entered the camper. They looked remarkably like Mexican bandits from a grade B movie. They had standard issue bandanas over their faces. There were four: the one with the rifle, the one with a rusty carving knife, one with a huge machete, and one unarmed. I was half surprised there weren't bandoliers slung over their shoulders. So while one man held me down to the floor, the rifle against my neck, the bandits started tearing the camper apart, yelling in Spanish. It's interesting. I realized that while I could do something, or at least had the illusion of being able to do something before, like start the car or save the family, I felt no fear, although there was adrenaline despair. But as I lay naked on the floor, cold steel against my neck, I started feeling quite helpless. And then I felt afraid. And then I began to shake. Now, this was an interesting situation. I was just about to get pretty in tune with my fear. In fact, I was only a moment or two away from losing it entirely. And then in a fleeting shred of self-consciousness, I reminded myself that this might be an excellent time to meditate and seek guidance. I remember breathing into my heart and asking God for help. And I heard quite clearly this passage from the 23rd Psalm came out of nowhere. "Thou shalt preparest a table before me in the presence of mine enemies." Huh? I don't get it, I thought. And then I saw an image of myself serving the bandits a feast. I thought to myself, I'm living in a reality where bandits have attacked me. I'm resisting, and it's a generally bad scene. Well, what if this wasn't so? What if they weren't bandits? What if they were old friends of ours who come to visit us in the cold desert night? What if I were actually glad to see them and welcome them as I would honored guests? What if I prepared a table for them? While one aspect of me was busy fantasizing horrendous scenes of rape and murder, a clear, quiet space opened inside of me that was intrigued by this new possibility. These two are children of God, I reminded myself. How many times have I declared that my purpose is to serve others? Well, here they are. I looked at the bandits from this more heartfelt awareness, and then I noticed, wait a minute, these aren't bandits, they're kids. It was suddenly apparent that these bandits were quite young, obviously inexperienced, and as I observed them now, rather inept, actually. They also seemed nervous. Their violence and yelling seemed more a product of their fear than their power. And in their thrashing about, they were making a terrific mess of things and actually losing a lot of the good loot. And in a rather bizarre flash of insight, I saw that serving a table in this moment meant to help them do a better job of robbing us. I turned to the young man who spoke English and said, "Hey, you're missing some of the best stuff. Under that pile over there is a very nice camera." He gave me a peculiar look. He yelled something in Spanish to one of the other young men who found the camera buried where I'd pointed. 35 millimeter. Takes great pictures, I offered helpfully. I spoke to the English-speaking man again. "Your friends are making such a mess. You're going to miss things. I'd be happy to show you where all the good stuff is." He looked at me strangely again. My responses were clearly not matching his script for bandits and victims. And as I pointed out other items in their hiding places, his suspicion gave way. I offered to get things for him and his friends. The next thing we knew, it was show and tell. "Nice guitar," I said. I demonstrated a few chords. "Who plays? Here, do you want it?" a Sony Walkman. Did I mention this is old? Yeah, Sony Walkman, headsets, batteries, some tapes. Yeah, real old. Who wants it? He said. I thought about the Native American giveaway and what we were doing. I realized that given our respective access to money, it seemed right somehow that they should receive our goods, a kind of balancing of wealth. I began to enjoy the feeling of gifting them. I tried to think which of our possessions they would enjoy the most. Although my out-of-role behavior was clearly having some impact on the scene, it was not yet a total transformation. The young man with the carving knife seemed particularly erratic, perhaps drug-intoxicated. Every few minutes, he pushed me or yelled at me. His English vocabulary seemed to consist of drugs, booze, more money. He found a bottle of Lomatil for diarrhea, you know, in a kitchen drawer. I tried to convince him that he didn't want those pills. And when he became violent about it, I have to confess, the thought occurred to me, it serves you right, just as I handed it over to him. My English-speaking friend increasingly began to play a calming role with the others. Well, I'd given away everything I could think of. And then I looked back toward the back of the van where Judith and Layla were huddled, wrapped in a blanket. Judith, of course, having her own fears and managing them, of concern for assault for herself and kidnapping of our child Layla, who was, in her whole 2 years of life, had never encountered someone who wasn't good. And she kept interjecting things like, "Daddy, who are these nice men?" I thought to myself, what's next? And then I found myself spontaneously asking, "Would you like something to eat?" The English-speaking young man translated. Four pairs of incredulous eyes looked at me as I proceeded to open the refrigerator. But now we had a cultural problem. As I surveyed the shelves of tofu, sprouts, yogurt, nut butters, I had that sinking feeling when you're hosting a dinner party and someone shows up on a special diet, you know? It was obvious that we had nothing recognizable as food. And then I saw a nice, red, delicious apple. Okay, that's normal food, I thought. So I took out the apple and I held it out toward the man with the machete. And that's when it felt like an important moment. In most cultures, the sharing of food is a kind of communion. It's an acknowledgement of friendship or declaration of peace. As I continued to hold out the apple toward him, I sensed him struggling for a moment, in his own way, letting go of the roles in which we had met. And for an instant, he smiled and then took hold of the apple. I flashed on the image of E.T. extending his light-tipped finger. As our hands met on the apple, I felt a subtle exchange of energy. Well, we had given presents and shared food. Now the English-speaking man said, we were going for a ride. Fear came back. I didn't know where they were taking us. If they were going to kill us, this was as good a place as any. They didn't seem competent enough to pull off a kidnapping and ransom. I suggested that they take the car and just leave us here. We were in the middle of nowhere, but anything seemed better than going driving with them. We exchanged views on this several times, and then all of a sudden they were back to threatening me with weapons. And I got it, and as soon as I switched back into fear mode, they became bandits again. Okay, let's go. I climbed into the back next to Judith and Layla, and away we went. I had my pants on now, which further improved my state of mind. I flipped in and out of realities at some moments, just driving through the desert. And then seeing lights, I planned how I might open the door and push Judith and Layla out if we slowed down near people. As we drove along, I asked myself, what would I do if I were driving along with my honored guests? Why, sing, of course. Judith, Layla, and I started singing. Listen, listen, listen to my heart song. Listen, listen, listen to my heart song. I will never forget you. Layla kept smiling, her outrageously cute smile. She'd catch the eye of one or another of the young men. Several times I saw them trying to keep it straight. Come on, kid, cut it out. I'm trying to be a bandit here. And then they'd smile despite themselves. They seemed to like the singing. We did. And then I realized I was failing to be a good host. They didn't know any of the songs we were singing. So I thought for a moment. Guantanamera. Guajira, Guantanamera. Guantanamera. That did it. They began singing along. The energy came together. No more bandits and victims. Feet were tapping, spirits lifted as we sailed through the desert night. We passed through a village without a chance for my great rescue attempt. And then the lights faded away as we entered some remote hilly country. We pulled down a dark dirt road and the RV came to a halt. And Judith and I looked at each other as we both had the thought that they were going to kill us after all. We rested deeply in each other's eyes. Then they opened the door and began to get out. Evidently, they lived far from the scene of the robbery. They had driven themselves home. Several of them said adios, and they exited. And finally, there was just my English-speaking friend in halting English as he struggled to communicate. Please forgive us, he said. Mis hombres y mi, we are poor people. Our fathers are poor. This is what we do for making the money. I'm sorry. We didn't know it was you. You're such a good man, and your wife and child so nice. He apologized again and again. You are good people. Please do not think bad of us. I hope this won't ruin your vacation. Then he reached into his pocket and took out my wallet. Here, he handed it back to me with my MasterCard. He goes, we can't really use this. Better you take it. And he also gave me my driver's license. And as one of his hombres stared in amazement, he even peeled off a few Mexican bills. Here, he said, for the gasoline. I was at least as amazed as his fellow bandits. He was giving my money back to me. He wants to make things right between us. And then he took my hand, he looked into my eyes, and the veils were gone between us. And just for a moment, we rested in that place. And then he said, adios, vaya con Dios. Our bandit guest disappeared into the night, and my family and I, we held each other and cried. Tikkun HaOlam is a Jewish mystical point of service. It means to repair the world. It is thought to be the purpose of every spiritual soul. Whatever it is we can do in our own ways, in the places where we live, where we serve, where we are, to do something to make the world better. The Talmud also says, to save a single life is to save the whole world. You can amend that into understanding that to change a life, to affect a life, to love a soul, a heart, to extend love, you're saving the world. So what does the world need now? Howard Thurman says, don't ask what the world needs. Ask what makes you come alive and go out and do it. Because what the world needs is people who have come alive. The world needs you, your compassion, your understanding, your love. Not with superhero qualities, but with our shared humanity. After all, as Ram Dass says, we're all just walking each other home. You are what the world needs now. And so I'm going to invite you now to internalize that. Just invite you to settle in place and take a deep breath in. And as you relax, let's move into our time of meditation now. Taking a deep breath and allowing yourself to breathe fully into what is the desire of your heart, what is deepest inside of you, where does your passion reside. What is your purpose? If you can do anything before you die, what would you do? What would you be? Who would you touch? In these moments, breathe deeply now into your heart. Deep breath in, all the way out. Keep that rhythm all the way in, all the way out. Feel the invigoration of divine life coursing through your physical being, bringing vitality and strength into every cell, tissue, organ, body system, organizing and aligning with your pure heart for service. And with another deep breath, drawing in divine love into your heart center, clearing a space for greater compassion, understanding, greater ability to love, to bring love, to be love. And with another deep breath in, divine light into your mind that erases stereotypes, quid pro quo and reasoning, and instead brings clear vision of understanding the truth beneath conditions, the love in every heart, and the fears we encounter that obscure that love. We breathe through that fear and ignite the love. We are connected by it. We are energized by it. It is our deepest, truest purpose. And with another deep breath in, let us now move into the center of our being, into the inner sanctuary of our hearts. And let us now sit there and wait and listen to that still small voice for God that speaks in the depths of us, that reveals to us our true purpose, that reminds us why we are here as we sit and listen now. Thank you, Blessed Spirit. For we do know that we have been given a gift, a vision, an idea, a thought, a new picture, a reframe, perhaps a feeling of peace or well-being. Whatever we are aware of having received in this time, let us bring it back with us into this time and place, knowing that many more gifts will be revealed in the coming hours and days, in times of struggle or challenge, in times of conflict or fear. We need remember only to turn inward and find our strength, our power. Our guidance is within. And so with this, we are grateful. We feel it already. We know it is true. And we are answering the call to what the world needs now. It is us. It is me. It is you. And we are answering the call with love in our hearts. And we are grateful. Thank you, God. So it is. Amen.